Hello there, I'm Tim and he's John and this is How to Murder Time, a podcast about games and things.
Everybody,
watcher.
It's a what we've been doing. It's a games show.
Yeah, let's all put the computer down and step away and talk about other things.
Yeah, because
it's a things show.
There are other things that happen that take up our time, which we don't usually talk about.
Yeah, we thought we'd try something a little bit different this week. I've got four books I've read recently that I'm going to talk about.
Don't worry, we probably won't get through all four.
Maybe not get through all of them, but we'll see how we go for time.
I've got a couple of TV shows.
You want to talk about TV
shows?
And I
might even mention a comic.
Yeah, okay then. Yeah, so let's talk about... Oh gosh, this is all weird and completely off mission, isn't it? I'm a bit nervous about it all, but I'm going to start. I got Ian M. Banks, The Hydrogen Sonata, here in my hand.
Ooh.
I've finished reading that a couple of months back. Not bad, not bad. It's obviously, there's a sort of sense of heightened anticipation and expectation with this one, because it's essentially certainly the last Culture novel he wrote before he died. Was there one of the Ian Banks as he did before?
The
Quarry, wasn't it? The Quarry. I don't know what that one's about. The Hydrogen Sonata, it's a Culture novel. It's one of these sort of tangential Culture adventures that he does, where it's almost like he's a bit bored of just banging on and on about what a perfect utopian society the Culture is and how it tends to fray apart at the slightest poking and provocation. And what we're looking at here is...
He's not a man who liked... utopias, was he?
Well, it's very easy to get the wrong end of the stick with the Culture novels. You're reading through this fantastic post-scarcity utopian society where super-intelligent machines run everything in a benevolent and fair fashion, and people generally just get to lark about all day long and can have everything they want. But almost all the sort of narrative adventure and tension comes from either single individuals in the Culture who, for some reason or another, don't like the status quo and want to get out, or admire alien species and sort of sympathise with them, or whole culture with a small c, sort of alien civilizations that sort of find themselves up against the Culture or competing with the Culture in some fashion. This is another one of those. This is about the civilization called the... Oh, God, pronunciation time. Here we go.
Uh-oh.
Gzilt, G-Z-I-L-T, and this is a sort of equivalent Equivtech, they call it in the book. Basically, a sort of an alien society on a similar sort of footing to the Culture, not too above or too below with the technology, and they are on the verge of subliming. And that pretty much is the whole sort of main running narrative throughout the book, is this whole species is on the verge. He calls it subliming. It's basically where an entire species has decided that they've had a good innings and they've had enough of this mortal coil and decide to all move on to the next stage, the whole sort of transcending to beings of pure energy state.
Basically, how you generally feel on a Tuesday morning.
Yeah, that sort of culture-wide ennui where you've done it all, really, and let's go and move on and try the next thing. And it's a topic he sort of comes back to again and again throughout the books. And that comes... The idea of subliming we first actually see in Consider Phlebas, his first Culture novel. So it's something that's always sort of going on in the background. And he's the galactic stage that he paints in which the Culture are happy bobbing along doing their thing. It's sort of littered with ancient worlds of species that have all gone on to the next thing. And there's a sort of, I don't know if it's a narrative get-out, because typically what he suggests is that any species that does sublime doesn't. No one comes back to tell you about it.
Yeah.
And there's a real huge metaphor with sort of, you know, contemporary thoughts on the afterlife and death and what comes beyond and so on. And it's something they sort of explore a little bit in this novel here. And it's quite an interesting sort of background to the whole thing. You've got a sort of narrative based on an individual as well, Veer Cossant, who's a member of this Gzilt civilization, who stumbles across a conspiracy within that civilization's own military and high up political players to try and conceal. And when the book opens, it's stated there's only like 20 days to go until the whole species just goes off into the next phase anyway. And so for the duration of that 20 days, the sort of political upper echelons are desperate to try and keep a particular secret, species-wide secret, concealed. And the Culture sort of get involved because they see weird things going on from next store and start busybodying in. And you get that usual sort of big email CC list of interested minds meddling with the political scene and sending agents and avatars in to deal with it all. Meanwhile, the Vera herself is trying to sort of get swept along a bit as well. I don't know. I sort of found it a bit meandering. There's a lot of interesting, fun set pieces there with lots of kick-ass gunplay and giant spaceships doing their thing. And, of course, the requisite large amount of big, stupid objects that Banks is so good at.
He does love his big, stupid objects.
Yeah, the Girdle City. One planet has a city that spans the... It's essentially a ring world, but wrapped around and on the surface.
That seems like the most impractical way to maximise your... The most efficient way of maximising your travel time.
One massive city spanning the equator that goes all the way around and is a couple of hundred feet high and has to have turbines because of the trade winds passing through it and stuff. It's that kind of thing. The hydrogen sonata of the title is actually the life task of Vir Kossom. Each of the members of this species sets themselves one massive task to complete in their lifetime, and the hydrogen sonata is this fabulously unplayable piece of music that you have to have a special musical instrument made up for. And she ends, I think, she, at the start of the book, she's had an extra pair of arms grafted on as well, because you need four arms to play this particular piece.
Has she heard of sequences?
I know. I think it's the spirit of the thing. She builds this giant sort of double bass type instrument that you sit inside like a moped to actually play the thing. It's just ridiculously stupid, and that's the point. It's setting this ridiculous task to try and achieve within your lifetime that she's gone for. But yeah, it does seem it's a bit bimbling, and in the end you sort of left with that sensation of I'm not quite sure what was resolved there or what the initial problem was. I mean, I don't want to sort of elaborate in particular on what the specific secret that they're all sort of scrabbling to find or hide is all about. But it's an all right culture novel. It's not the best. I think I'd probably still rate Accession and as perhaps probably the better culture novel that I've read. And to be honest, I think Against a Dark Background is probably his best sci-fi novel anyway. You know, it moves away from the culture and deals with real people and an interesting sort of out there, off a world we never see again.
So, I do feel that he did way too much for the culture.
Yeah, and it must have been a difficult thing.
Most of the culture books do seem like it was an excuse to get away from the culture anyway.
Yeah, a lot of the early culture stuff is quite fascinating, but the very first one, Consider Phlebas, is not even about the culture anyway. They're essentially the antagonists in that story. So how do you write interesting narrative about a perfect utopian society? What you have to start peeling away at it. You have to start implying and examining why it's not as utopian as it seems, because essentially conflict tends to drive the story most of the time, and if everyone's happy all the time. I think Player of Games is probably the best culture outing that I remember reading, but so this one's not bad. I think I would recommend it. I'd give it a go, certainly. But I suppose there's a certain historical aspect to it all. I mean, I guess when he was writing this, he must have known about his condition.
Yes,
was it liver? Some sort of.
It might have been. I can't remember exactly what the problem was.
Yeah, it was some sort of long prognosis. You would have known it was coming. So I'm wondering how much of that is reflected in the sort of narrative and the tone of the book that I was reading through. It is essentially about an up and coming assignation with the next and the beyond. You know, the whole society in this book is essentially waiting to move on to the next world, waiting to die, I suppose, in a way. Yeah, they all go off to become, group consciousness beings of pure energy or whatever at the end of it all, but it is essentially the end of a lot of things all coming together at once. And the majority of the main story of the book is essentially about tidying up unfinished business or trying to, just get to the end without it all falling apart. And I just wonder, that's got to have reflected, because the previous culture novel, Surface Detail, that was essentially an examination of what happens when your technological society is actually able to create real heaven and hell. Which was what largely went through most of that book, an examination of digital simulated afterlives being imposed by various cultures on its citizens as a kind of way to reinforce their moralistic values. So, it seems a lot of the... I don't know what The Quarry was about. I don't know what is Ian Banks' stuff in the last couple were about, but I think you're going to... If you know you're dying, it's going to reflect in your work, surely.
Yeah, you just need to take a look at Pratchett. who has made conscious decisions to remove a certain character from his books.
I've really not read any of the very latest Pratchett stuff.
But
really,
he's no longer writing about death.
Right.
Because he decided it was a little bit...
Was it Gemmell as well?
Yes, Gemmell's books are mainly... about cancer.
He was in remission, or he got better, or something.
He started when he was diagnosed, all his books are all about the struggle, and it's all basically a metaphor for his struggle.
Mm. I suppose there must be a temptation to let that sort of absolutely wash over everything you're writing if it's, you know, always in the forefront of your mind, intense personal circumstances. I have no idea how much, obviously I don't know a lot about Ian Banks's real life. I mean, I don't know how much of it sort of came through. I think it's a good completionist one, though. It's good, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think it's his best. I don't think it's great, but if you're collecting them all, I don't think you'll be dissatisfied with this one. So Ian M. Banks' Hydrogen Sonata.
Yeah, that's quite a hefty tome.
Yeah, 600 pages, $8.99 from Orbit Books, probably Amazon. You can find
a lot cheaper on Amazon. Yeah,
pretty much everything's on Amazon. We're going to be talking about today. Everything everywhere's on Amazon all the time.
Actually, no.
No.
Only one of my things is on Amazon.
You found a thing.
One of my things is specifically not on Amazon.
You found a thing you cannot buy on Amazon.
Yeah.
My word.
Admittedly, my first thing was made by Amazon.
All right, let's talk about your thing.
Okay, I've been spending a little bit of time exploring the wonders of TV shows.
Okay.
Because, I discovered that was a thing that not enough people were doing.
I've really gotten out of the habit of watching TV at all. I just seem to have drifted away from it. It used to be the centre of the family focus and everything when I was growing up, but I've just...
Yeah,
I watch telly.
Don't watch broadcast TV anymore.
I watch a bit on Saturday nights sometimes when my mum comes to visit because it's a social thing, but I don't generally sit there on my own watching telly. I'll be on the computer. Yeah.
Anything I watch on broadcast TV is something I've recorded, and even then there's only a couple of shows.
Yeah, and even if I do watch telly, it's going to be iPlayer, it's going to be ITV player, whatever. It's going to be some sort of watch later service. I think broadcast television's probably on the way out.
Oh, it is. And one of the reasons why it's on the way out is for services like Netflix. And in this case, Amazon Video.
I really need to get Netflix or something. I'm just going to have nothing left to watch eventually.
Amazon Video.
Oh, landslide.
Amazon Video started making some original programming.
Oh, they're doing their own.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like Netflix are, which we'll get to in a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically, as a way of sweetening the deal, making you want to get Amazon Prime, which includes Amazon Video.
Mm
hmm. Which, yeah, I've got Amazon Prime anyway because of the amount of crap I get.
Yeah.
So one of the shows they've made is a show called Alpha House, which I was sitting here playing Minecraft, as I constantly do. I decided I wanted something on in the background because I was basically just watching flow through pipes.
That's something I've never been able to do, is have the telly on and pay any attention to it whilst I'm gaming. I can't split my attention. It's terrible.
So what you need to do is play a game which is so unengaging.
No, even stuff like Minecraft, I'm always rushing around doing this, doing that. I just can't unfocus from the monitor when I'm using PC gaming or anything. So.
Well, my sorting system takes half an hour to sort a single block at the moment, so I just watch it go down pipes. Anyway, yes,
yeah.
Alpha House is an Amazon original TV show about a bunch of US Republican senators who share a house.
Okay.
Which is based on a real thing.
Right, okay.
Because as you probably do know, in America, the political system is all based around Washington.
Okay, yeah.
So you get elected as a senator of your state, get sent to Washington, your family's back in your state, so you need somewhere to live in Washington.
All right, okay, yeah, that seems...
And so, you either rent a house or whatever, and in this case, a bunch of real-life senators were living together in a house.
Oh.
And so they decided that was a great idea for a TV show, and they made one.
It is a sitcom waiting to happen, isn't it?
It is a comedy.
Okay, yeah.
Now... It's not what you expect. When you hear that, what do you think? What do you
think?
I think
of wacky hijinks and laughter tracks and just crazy.
You're
capers
thinking a bit
things.
Of Animal House, aren't you?
Oh yeah, that thing with Charlie Sheen in as well.
Yeah, and maybe a little bit of
Two and a Half Men.
Yes,
I don't know. Just some sort of really awful, wacky living in a all sat where the sofa's facing out of the telly at you, and they're all having bing bong. Oh, it's mystery guest of the week who's come to do a hilarious thing. It sounds awful.
Frankly. I was also thinking a little
convince
bit.
Me otherwise.
A little bit of Young Ones, maybe.
A bit
of Bottom.
Uh-huh.
That would all be brilliant. But no, it's nothing
lots of
like
cricket
this.
Bats.
What it basically is.
Okay.
It starts off thinking like it might be that. There's a Bill Murray a cameo at the start.
Yeah, right.
Which, yeah, you know what he's like.
Yeah.
And it stars John Goodman.
Okay.
As one of the senators,
yep.
As well as Clark Johnson, Matt Malloy, and Mark Consuelos, who are four senators living in this house and just generally doing senator type stuff.
Which I have trouble with this because when I think of senator, I do a sort of basic mental translation in my head, and I'm thinking House of Lords and Peers of the Realm and stuff, and I can't imagine anything energetic, let alone funny, happening with a house full of those.
Well, no.
I think it's probably different in America. I probably don't understand the politics.
It is nothing like that. It's more like MPs, really.
Oh, okay. So what's the senators and the other? What's the opposite? The other House of Senators, congressmen. I don't know. Oh, whatever. Anyway.
Yes. Basically, what happens is it's their story of them doing their politics thing, and it's mainly a story about John Goodman's re-election campaign,
okay.
Which goes from he's been a senator for many, many years, a surefire winner. Because one thing that you get with senators is very, very popular ones who are in power for 40 years.
Okay.
And he suddenly gets competition and he has to start campaigning.
Right.
And you've got these four different, very different senators who live together and try and deal with their various situations, like being investigated for fraud or things like that. And it's actually quite good. It's not laugh out loud Animal House comedy, like you would expect. It's a bit more subtle. It's a lot more situational.
Bit more subtle comedy, yeah.
It's got John Goodman in, so it's always going to be watchable.
Mm.
And it almost sways into serious occasionally.
So we're sort of talking the thick of it, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's I'm not quite so outrageous thick of it.
All right. Yeah, that sounds interesting. Do you feel, as a British person watching this, that you're getting all the references, that it's hitting home?
Yes, but then again...
Is a lot of what's going on just not really translatable?
Is this
largely for an American audience, would you say?
No, it's very translatable. And if you see a single episode of The Daily Show or something, you're going to get half the references.
Oh, fair enough.
Because, well, it's all very universal. And everyone knows about the problems in American politics. They touch quite a lot on the fact that the Republicans can't be seen talking to Democrats.
Is it quite preachy, or is the comedy sort of somewhat divorced from actual American politics?
It touches on it occasionally, but it's nowhere near as preachy as you think it would be. Because it's told from a Republican point of view, but it's not pro-Republican.
Partisan, I think, is the word I'm looking for, isn't it? Yeah.
But it's quite pro-Democrat in the fact that the Democrats come out looking a lot more sensible than the Republicans.
But I suppose I wouldn't really be wanting to watch something like this that was clearly trying to make one party or another look stupid, you know? I'd like to see... If it's going to go for political satire, I want to see everyone daubed with the brush, you know?
Yeah. It doesn't quite go that far, but it gives the Republicans far more sympathy than you get in something like any of the other more Democrat-based comedies.
So it must be quite a difficult line to tread, quite a sort of dangerous topic to play with too extensively if you get too involved and start, you know, picking up your own personal politics when you're writing it, that sort of thing.
Yes, well, that's always going to be there. You just have to watch something like The West Wing, which I know you haven't watched.
I haven't watched a lot of, no.
Which, yeah, a fantastic show, but incredibly Democrat-focused.
Right.
Very preachy from that point of view.
Okay.
Where, in places. Other times it wasn't at all.
Yeah.
So it's almost impossible to write a political comedy which doesn't get a bit preachy, because even The Thick of It is very well situated in its political place.
I mean, sort of thinking Yes Minister as well. So I've got some of the ones they did that on Radio 4 a while back, and I recorded a few, and I do listen to them again, and I have real trouble trying to work out which party Jim Hacker was supposedly a member of. They never mention it in the show at all. There's no actual party names used, but the politics of it all, it could quite easily be Labour or Tory or whatever.
I
think that's some very clever writing there.
I was assumed it was a Conservative government, but he was quite clearly, I think, meant to have been Labour.
Yeah, it's just sort of really quite... quite well written, but also sort of detached somewhat. And yet the comedy never suffered for it, because it could easily have applied to anyone.
But the statement really they were making in that was, it doesn't matter who was in power.
Yes, yes.
The political party was irrelevant. It's the same people with the power.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, that's a very interesting take they took on it.
Yeah, yeah. And you really didn't get that at all. Well, I mean, in the thick of it, they actually meant it is the parties are named and everything, and they're very idiosyncratic of the politics of the modern day. So I don't think that sort of approach would have worked. So does this thing? So we got like ongoing story arcs.
Yes,
here,
yes, they all run basically back and one into each other,
and sort of leading up to a particular election, presumably for the blokes campaigning. That sort of thing.
It runs up to John Goodman's election at the end, and stuff like going off campaigning, being seen in Afghanistan.
So I guess this is really quite new. So there's only the current series. Yeah, first series.
They only commissioned the second series in January.
So it got a second series.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So no, that's good.
well.
And we're talking American TV show series, so we're talking, what, 13 episodes, something like that?
Well,
they don't tend to do the six-episode runs.
It's 11.
Here. 11, okay.
Yes, you've got the half-season ones or the full-season shows, And it's basically... there's this new wave of short-run TV shows, because I think they realised that...
It's all moving to binge watching.
Well, a lot of the writers have realised that 24 episodes may be a bit too thin to stretch a season.
Was it half an hour, 42 minutes? It's
half hour, so.
Yeah, okay.
It's a very short show.
Hmm.
And it does, you will get through the entire series in an evening if you're not careful.
Well, that's the way we're increasingly watching TV series now, isn't it? In one go as a box set, the box set binge, as they call it. You know, I mean, the having to pace it and span it out over a broadcast schedule over a year or something is becoming less and less relevant, I suppose.
Oh yeah, and this was actually released weekly, unlike say what Netflix do, which is release all the episodes in one day, which is an interesting way of doing it, because it comes out on the Friday, you just watch it all.
Yeah.
It should possibly mention the fact that this is always going to be compared to Netflix's remake of House of Cards.
Okay, I'd heard a fair bit about that, yeah.
Yeah, which is...
Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, Kevin Spacey, who is fantastic in that.
Mm.
It was a show I was really, really worried about, but actually it is comparable in quality to the first one.
To be honest, I haven't seen the original House of Cards either. I need to watch both of those back-to-back and see which one's
the best.
They're
both on Netflix.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is mostly a show about selling me Netflix, isn't it?
Well,
this one's on
Netflix
Amazon.
Or Amazon,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Weirdly.
Right. So.
So what we've determined is you haven't seen any good TV show ever.
I think we're about to determine you haven't read any good books in a long time.
I think it might be reading.
So, okay, where do we find this then? Obviously, Amazon.
Amazon Video.
How much is it?
Oh.
Do you buy it as the whole series, I suppose? Or
no. It's part of your subscription.
Oh, you have to subscribe up to... Oh, so you can't just go out and buy this. Presumably it'll be along as a DVD set or something.
Oh, it usually is, I guess.
Or Blu-ray or whatever.
I mentioned that, but you just part your subscription. So if you've got Amazon Prime, you already have it.
Okay, so you don't get to see this unless you sign up for the full Amazon package at the moment.
Yeah.
But presumably there'll be something else somewhere.
I don't know.
Is that the way, platform-exclusive TV shows now? Because you're selling a subscription, you're selling membership.
Amazon and Netflix and the others are going out of their way to make TV shows that are good enough to capture a market.
It makes sense. They're basically the ones with all the money nowadays. Yeah. They are the studios. They are the distribution.
Broadcast TV is looking a little bit shaky.
Yeah, it must be terrifying.
when you've got a new means of broadcasting, which everyone's got, which is being able to stream HD
already
over the
in everyone's homes, the technology is basically there for most people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you need the license to run a station?
Yeah, yeah.
Or a network.
Especially when you could close all that down and sell that off for mobile phone spectrum or something.
Yeah. Yeah, so I recommend people watch this. It's a very fun way to spend an evening or two. It'd be interesting to see if season two can keep going as interestingly, because there is a definite plot arc in this, telling a story with lots of stuff going on around it.
Mm.
So it's... be interesting to see if their second season has a good enough hook to keep you going for that one as well.
Yeah, okay, cool. Right, I'm going to talk about my next book. It's Red Seas Under Red Skies by Scott Lynch. This is the second in a series.
Uh-oh.
So it works well enough as a standalone. You can pick it up and read it and get into it, but there's going to be a fair bit of background you'll probably be missing.
How long is the series going to be?
I don't know. I think he's done his third one at the moment recently, but I don't buy hardback books because they're just awkward artifacts. They're big, heavy, and they don't fit in shelves properly, so I always wait for books to come out in paperback before I buy them. It's a kind of literary three-month rule, but only it lasts a bit longer.
See, I do the opposite. I click a button and it downloads to my tablet.
Oh, I know. I'm about the whole e-reader thing. I don't want to have to buy all my books again.
Those paper books will not disappear.
I know, but if you're going to stop collecting the books, and I like books. I like the physical artifact. Listen to that. You don't get that with an
Actually,
e-reader.
No, the
smell. Oh, I'm huffing a paperback at the moment here. It's magnificent.
I will admit there are some books I still buy.
I do like, and just seeing all the spines there on a bookcase in my bedroom or whatever. You know,
all that space that could just be taken up with one Kindle.
One USB stick. Yes, you could theoretically fit all my books onto one very slimline e-reader or Kindle or whatever. But I'm not going to. So there. Anyway, back to the book. Scott Lynch's Red Seas Under Red Skies. This is basically the sequel to The Lies of Loch Lomora, which I talked about a little bit on the Steam group. We have actually got a book club thread on there that no one's touched for in a while, so feel free to necro that thread and bring it back up and have a read through on there. So The Lies of Loch Lomora, just a bit of background, is essentially it's a ripping yarn set. Follows the adventures of Loch Lomora, who's basically a trained from a scamp thief in a sort of fantasy pseudo medieval magical Renaissance Venice type of setting. It's a sort of kind of parallel world where there's alchemy and magic and so on, but the technology's a bit forward of the usual medieval knights and swords and stuff. And we're basically talking city states in a Renaissance Venice type setting, and really well realised as well. Lynch has a real sort of a gift for the descriptive flair as well, the cities that they're in, the capers that they're engaged in, and so on. So it's Locke and his best friend and survivor of the previous book, Jean.
Spoiler.
I know, a bit of a spoiler there, sorry. The book has been out for a while. They've basically been driven out of the city of their birth, and they're off to a whole new city to start a whole new caper and try and repatch their lives together. And basically, Lynch sort of tells the story in a kind of backwards, forwards, flashback, flash forward type thing, which does really pique the interest and keep things moving along as well. You're sort of looking back at bits and pieces, and the history of what's going on has been being revealed as the main narrative carries forward as well. So you have to keep an eye out for that. But they're basically trying to perform a heist on one of the world's most famous casinos, essentially. Yes, it is a kind of heist novel, but things get really out of hand when they get picked up by the locals or warlord and sort of coerced into becoming pirates, essentially. So you've got a whole sort of mid section of the book, which is essentially a ripping yarn on sea battles and boats and so on. Really good fun. I like it. But quite a lot of harsh sacrifice going on throughout the thing as well. But real sort of adventurous tale of daring do, and the really likeable protagonist as well. Locke himself is a fantastic character. It's well realised. And you're just sort of rooting for him to rob everyone blind most of the way through. And it's fascinating to see how the actual caper pans out as well. You know, everyone, I love a good sort of caper, good heist story.
Yeah, everyone loves a good heist.
And this and The Lies of Lomora both sort of pan out as that kind of thing, as well as the overall plot that's going on as well. Fantastic. I would highly recommend this indeed. I think the first book's probably stronger. This one is a bit more. Well, for starters, you've got this whole problem of coming in on a saga halfway through. Fortunately, I'd read the first one, but if you just picked this up and went for it, you wouldn't get as much out of it as if you'd been following the whole thing all the way through. It's not actually a trilogy as such, but they do sort of follow on from each other. But the sort of change of scene and pace from the first book, where sort of now we're talking swashbuckling pirate adventure as well as big sort of big casino caper thing going on as well, and the preparations for it and all the rest of it. Good stuff. I like it. And lots of overarching threads as well that sort of continue on from the first book and also move on into the third one, which I haven't got yet. That one's called The Republic of Thieves, so that should be interesting. I'm guessing Ian Locke, our hero there, ends up as some kind of in charge of a town or nation. So that might be interesting to see what as well. I like it. Good solid ripping yarn there. About 600 pages again.
All books are 600 pages.
I guess you just start to have physical problems when they get much thicker than that.
Yeah.
So this is
imagine the collected works of David Eddings.
It just wouldn't work in one volume. I've got all of those as well.
Why?
My Private Shame. I like them. I grew up reading those lots, but I don't expect anyone else to like them.
No, a surprising amount of people have no taste in books.
You don't know till you try. So this is Gallant's Fantasy, Ryan Books, $8.99, and I guess you can find that on Amazon as well, because that's where everything is nowadays.
Yes,
the big bookshop. But I recommend that highly. But particularly, I would suggest if you're interested, go for the first one first, The Lies of Locke Glamora. But Red Seas Under Red Skies is a good solid continuation of what's shaping up to be an epic saga.
Cool.
Very enjoyable. Like it.
Okay.
Over to you.
I'm going to talk about a Netflix show now, because, you know, I've just been watching TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
This is Orange is the New Black.
Okay, what's that?
This is a story about a woman who has a bit of a murky past, who gets sent to prison.
Okay.
Hence Orange is the New Black.
Jumpsuit, oranges. Yeah, I see.
And she has an interesting time climatising to prison and getting on.
It's already sounding quite bleak and not my cup of tea, but
I'm
wrong.
It's very, very entertaining and quite aspirational in a funny kind of way.
Okay. Prison comedy. Are we talking sort of My Name is Earl sort of thing here?
Yeah, but not as wacky.
Okay.
It's more amusing situations and stuff like that.
I loved My Name is Earl until the whole third series where he spent the whole of it in prison or something, and that just got really boring.
Yeah, it's... Imagine the boring third season of My Name is Earl, and it's nothing like that.
Okay, excellent.
It stars Taylor Schilling as Piper Chapman, who is a woman living in New York who's sentenced to 15 months in prison for transporting a suitcase full of drug money for her former girlfriend.
Right.
Now, she's moved on from that life and is engaged to marry a guy played by Jason Biggs.
Uh-huh.
And part of the story is them and their relationship, as they're obviously on either side of a prison wall.
It's a difficult sell.
Yeah.
Prison not being places of huge jollity.
Well, you say it's a difficult sell, but one of the things that is less than impressive about the show is the way they sold the pilot.
Okay.
It came from a process at Netflix to... They made lots and lots of pilots for shows, let people watch them and vote on them, and the ones that were more popular they made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the pilot, it cheated.
Oh.
With women's prison.
Yeah.
If you're going out doing a show about women's prison, what's the angle you take to guarantee you're going to get lots and lots of views?
Lots of catfighting or something?
Lots and lots of nudity.
Right, okay.
Which, you know, evaporates episode two.
they got the series right. We don't have to do that now. You could be a bit more sensible. Right.
The prison is made up of interesting characters, of course.
Okay, yeah.
And it's basically some episodes are seeing each bit of the politics inside, or dealing with the rather ineffectual guards who are rubbish, that sort of thing. The interesting thing about the show,
mm-hmm,
is a character called Red, who runs the prison's kitchen.
Okay.
A Russian woman.
Yeah.
Who's played by Catherine Mulgrew.
Oh, good grief. Wow.
In the most opposite of Janeway character you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Doing a hilarious Russian accent or something, yeah. Is it? Okay, right.
Yeah, which works really well. She's possibly the most interesting character.
She sounds like she's supposed to be just a sort of cameo celebrity supporting character rather than driving the narrative particularly. And so she's the most interesting person there, then, I wonder.
She's, because of the way that, as the person who runs the kitchen, it's a very powerful job.
Mm.
She's got her fingers in everything. And
okay.
That's what makes it an interesting... power. The entire show is basically about the different power groups inside prison, the different gangs and groupings of people and how they work. So
the internal politics of it all.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And so it'll be basically her against each group each week, in effect, or maybe just an entire episode about seeing a chicken.
Right.
Which was an interesting episode. There's a chicken loose in the prison yard, and no one will believe it because the chicken's a myth.
Right, I see. That's a metaphor for freedom or something, is it?
Yes, funnily enough.
Right.
Especially at the end when she sees a chicken on the other side of the prison fence.
I see.
Yeah, because the chicken's free where she's not.
It sounds like I'd have to watch it to know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
No, right? It is a good thing. Yeah. It's a very, very entertaining show. It's enough happens to keep you interested. It's something like 13 episodes a season. Only the first season's out, but the second season starts week after the next, I think. And it is incredibly good. It's very watchable. It's amusing enough to keep you going as well, and it is definitely worth a try.
So, sort of prison drama. There's the risk of quite harsh bleakness to it.
Yeah, it avoids the harsh bleakness.
Okay.
If you just... Well, apart from the hopelessness which is rained down on her repeatedly as her attempts to do anything go horribly wrong at the start as she... She brings in her not in prison attitude to life in prison, and it sort of doesn't quite go against the a problem of the
sort of fish out of water comedy, is it?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But as she adapts and it goes on further, it gets a bit easier.
Okay, so we're talking story arc here as well.
Is that
typically what people do with series?
Yeah,
stuff
all
now?
TV shows have a story arc.
Not necessarily. A lot of series stuff is all status quo. Nothing really pushing forward. I don't know if that's the case these days. I haven't watched in a while.
Most shows now don't have the state. They have the status quo, and then there will be a bit larger overarching plot to keep going because people have realised that you need to have something to bring them back next week. Rubbish like he says about to offend loads of people. Even rubbish like the remake of Hawaii 5-0, instance.
Wow,
which that is tosh of the highest order. Even that has.
But I think that's a relatively recent thing, though, because I mean, sort of looking back to, I'm just thinking of The Prisoner, for example. That was essentially a show about back to square one at the start each week. But I suppose that was more sort of tapping into the futility of trying to escape.
Yes. It's sort of thing that it kicked off. Remember when Babylon 5 came along with its grand plans?
Well, that was quite innovative and surprising in its time because here was something that we were going to spend a couple of years working towards story wise, whereas predecessors shows, I don't know, the original Star Trek and stuff, there was no, well, even Next Generation or whatever. There's no real sense.
It wasn't until DS9 got to a certain point in the late 90s where these shows were happening.
I think that's a courage thing, really. It's that you've got to feel confident that your show is going to go for X number of years or months. Because otherwise you end up in a situation where you're just writing shows where at any point the series could just stop and vanish.
Basically what happens now.
Nothing ever is resolved. They don't work towards anything. We're all back to where we were at the beginning of the next episode. It's all very modular. If you could show the episodes in any order you like...
Well, then take something like Dollhouse, which was completely destroyed. Have you seen Dollhouse?
No. I'm not helping much.
Which was a show which was completely destroyed by the usual problem that he has, which is the...
messed about with by the network.
The network shows it out of order, so it doesn't make sense, and then cancels it before it gets a chance to finish it.
Yeah.
And so all the plot ends up in the last episode.
Yeah.
Shows now are allowed to have sequential plots, and they're expected to, in a way, even if it is just something big is happening in the background and occasionally you have a plot episode.
Do you think the movement towards just selling the box set directly to the customer is helpful for that?
Yes, because, well, if you look at, say, Sky, they're advertising for a TV show.
The fact that it's going to be broadcast on some kind of terrestrial television is almost irrelevant at that point.
Sky, for their on-demand stuff, on your Skybox, say... They actually call it a box set still.
Yeah.
So if you want a TV show, here's the entire show for you to watch still.
That's got to be the sensible way of doing it. You can pick your own time still. Yeah. You don't have to wait for a particular spot every week to see it.
It's still the weekly broadcast stuff for the stuff that's coming out weekly.
Yeah.
But stuff that's been out already, you can just watch it all. Which, it's the only way, really, that you're going to keep people coming back. I mean, look at the success of something like Game of Thrones, which I know for a fact you have watched.
I've seen some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, you
had to borrow the box sets off my mum. I don't even own a Blu-ray player, people.
I know, it's terrible. Although, you're excused for not owning a Blu-ray player because Blu-rays failed as a medium.
Oh, okay. Yes, I always knew that was the case. I was waiting for the mind crystals. Are mind crystals here yet?
No.
No.
Guess what killed it?
What killed Blu-ray?
Netflix.
So we just don't even have media
anymore.
Yeah,
what's the point of having media where you can just view it?
Enough.
Yeah. on demand.
Yeah.
You fancy watching, say, all of Buffy back to back, you can.
So there won't
not
be any
that
mind,
happened this week.
There won't be any mind crystals, so I'm gonna have to wait for mind internet. Oh dear.
Wow, just what I'm
mind fi.
Wow.
Mm.
Do you think that's a good idea?
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, true.
So, Orange is the New Black.
Yes. Very, very good show. I definitely recommend people watch it.
Okay. So, well, we've got two series there, is it?
Second series starts week after next.
Okay. So, again, this is quite pretty fresh and modern.
Oh, yeah. All
recent.
This stuff is very, very fresh.
Okay.
Yeah. So, watch it. It's available if you've got Netflix.
Yep.
And if you haven't got Netflix, you're weird like Tim.
I'm weird.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm weird, and I'm going to talk about a book made of paper. You see, what they do is they chop loads and loads of trees down and they sort of pulp them and rot them and press them and dry them out, and then they put marks on the pages, and these marks, they correspond to things that are word shapes in your headspace.
Why would they do that?
I don't know. But it's a habit I've gotten into. I'm going to talk about The Prefect by Alastair Reynolds. I've only just recently discovered Alastair Reynolds, but he's been going a fair bit.
I've known about him for years. Yes. I probably should have mentioned him.
I mean, it sounds quite harsh, but I was sort of looking for an Ian M. Banks replacement, because what would there not going to be any more of them? And I thought, well, there's quite a lot of other large doorstoppers of the sort I like.
Are we really ever going to get one Ian M. Banks?
Mm, probably, yeah. But there's a lot of these doorstopper series with all similar typography on the spines in the science fiction and fantasy pariah section of the of Waterstones when you wander in there.
The one that makes them the most money, probably.
Well, yeah, I don't know. But I no see. I,
What's
I,
a bookshop?
I've gotten well, exactly. I've gotten into trawling charity shops for books instead now, because I'm very much of the opinion that, you know, make, do, amend, recycle, reuse.
Don't give any money to
a book
authors.
Is for everyone. Well, yeah, that's the downside.
You're
isn't
destroying.
It? I'm an evil, nasty person.
You are, yeah.
But
if novels stop tomorrow, it's your fault.
Well, that's thrown me. I don't know what to say to that accusation. I'm a terrible person because I don't pay full price in bookshops.
Well, no one pays full price in bookshops. There was a court case about that.
Oh, I don't care. I spent £10 and I got 5 of these.
Oh,
so,
excellent.
You know. It's actually RRP £7.99 and I only paid £1.50 for it. So there. I think I'm the winner there.
I think you are, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, it's very good. So the Prefect. So this, the Revelation Space series. It's basically Revelation Space is the one he did first. Now the real problem here is I'm coming into the wrong volume in the big old established series. The Revelation Space is, I presume, the one you're supposed to read first. Because that talks about a sort of futuristic society of humankind. I think we're talking, I don't even know what the year is, year 3000 something or other.
It's 2014.
No, not now, you fool, in the book.
Okay.
It didn't actually say. But the mankind is spread amongst the stars. They're still recognisably mankind, but something Reynolds explores quite a lot is the idea of transhumanism, as there's various factions within the greater humankind in this sort of series and genre and space, and various sort of augmented types. There's like the conjoiners, who are like, they were referred to as the spiders, and they're basically humans with a great deal of neural augmentation and hive mind consciousness implants and all the rest of it and that kind of thing. And there's all sorts of other factions there, the ultras, who are basically sort of they've self-adapted for deep space voyaging between star systems and so on. I don't think we're talking warp drives or faster than light drives, that sort of thing. It's more suspended animation and so on.
That's
so
boring. You miss all your TV shows.
There's a sort of, it's difficult to use the term realism when applied to this kind of, you know, post, you know, several thousand years into the future sci-fi, but you could at least follow the dots, and it all seems internally consistent. It's not all just, you know, see, something I always sound a bit, yeah, somewhat sort of jarring with Ian M. Banks' culture stuff is the whole sort of, we're so sufficiently advanced that we don't need to explain how our magic works. It's all sort of vast hyperspace technologies, nanomachines, whatever, and you almost get the sense that Banks isn't that terribly interested in the specifics of the technology anyway. It's all there as running plot devices to allow the kind of societies he wants to explore to happen. Reynolds seems to sort of talk a bit more, go into a bit more depth, a bit more, not you know, vast technical readouts and pages of techno babble, but you get the sense that these are more recognisably human beings in a kind of anticipatable future than in the culture where it is all functional magic. Yeah, so The Prefect, this follows the story of Tom Dreyfus, who is a prefect. He is the prefects are a member of an organisation called Panoply, which is a kind of police force for a vast society of orbital habitats around the planet Yellowstone. And there's like 10,000 different space stations all floating, zooming around this planet, and they each of them runs their own little miniature government, their own kind of internal society, and their own sort of their own tropes and their own approaches to, you know, transhumanism and what baseline human is and what is and isn't acceptable ways to govern themselves into the future. And yet somehow, because all these habitats are all part of the same sort of, even from a navigational sense, they're all in the same orbits and stuff, so there needs to be a kind of overriding authority trying to keep it all together, which is what this Panoply organisation is, and they're essentially space policemen. And the book opens with quite a heinous crime. Someone directs a rocket engine into a habitat and kills everyone on board.
That's
and so,
not very nice.
No, it's a bad crime. It kills 900 people, and that's the sort of opening of the book, and Dreyfus is there trying to investigate and get to the bottom of that, but obviously that's not just the end of it all. That starts to uncover further conspiracies, and before long the entire orbital... The glitter band, the orbital habitat system, is under sustained assault from a malign artificial intelligence, and there's all sorts of mayhem and hijinks there. Really good fun. It's an interesting sort of blend of action and speculative science fiction there, you know, you're sort of following it through, and I found it very enjoyable indeed. I liked it. It's good. I'm reading another of Reynolds's books as well at the moment. I haven't really finished it. I'm trying to work out where it all fits together. I think one of the strengths is the continuity, but in this sort of pocket universe he's created in this time and place, and the consistent and sort of the themes that follow through. You have the same factions there, the same sorts of places, and it all takes place in different periods of time around this particular planet. See, this one it comes in quite early, and then the one I'm reading is also talking about a melding plague, and they call the glitter band the Rust Belt in that book. So I'm guessing there's a book somewhere I haven't read yet where it talks about a massive catastrophe.
This one
has a load of portents and foreshadowings to that event that I know nothing about. And the other one I'm reading is talking about the fallout and consequences of that event I know nothing about. So
it's just the problem with your charity shop.
If I'd have just gone straight to Waterstones, I could have bought the first one. Yeah. So again, they're not really sold as sequels. And you know, a trilogy or whatever, but you do get the sense that you're missing quite a bit without having
independent
read the right
books
one.
That hang together.
Yes, I think Revelation Space is probably the one I need to find, because that seems to be the first
in
one.
My
that, you've got it, have you?
I think so. Yeah.
Have you read it? Do you remember anything about it?
I have read it.
Okay, good. Didn't mean to put you on the spot there with a book.
No, it was years ago.
I think Revelation Space is probably the starting point. This one's supposed to be some sort of prequel to it. It's great, though. Really good, strong characterisation, particularly the inevitable bent Panoply fella who's working against them all from the inside. It turns out to be a real monstrous villain, and yet and sort of identifiable at the same time as well. You can see his motives and the reasoning why he's turned against his own, but just the sheer amount of spanners he throws into the works as they're going through all of this stuff. Meanwhile, you've got the sort of rookie new recruit who's on the squad as well, and she's halfway around the belt with massive problems of her own, with machines running amok after she sort of botches an upgrade to the polling core, which is like the sort of computer systems that Panoply put into each habitat, which allow democratic voting to be impartially observed for the whole system and so on. And then the clockmaker, I'm not even going to talk about that, but that's a terrifying concept as well. It's really interesting. Lots of hooks. It's not so much the big stupid objects that Banks likes. It's more the fascinating jeopardy that Reynolds likes to put his people, his characters into. There's a fair bit of almost sort of sci-fi body horror appearing in places here and there. But they're not really horrific hack and slash novels, but just interesting amounts of threat and peril. I quite enjoyed it. So that's, The Prefect, Alistair Reynolds, Orion Books again, $7.99. So you can probably find that. Why am I even bothering telling people where they can find this stuff? It's like we're trying to do a proper book review show or something, and everyone can type www.amazon.com search.
If any of our listeners didn't know how to find a book, I would despair. The youth of today is not that ruined.
Anyway, so there you go. I like that, but I think if you're going to go out, Alistair Reynolds, fantastic author, very good. I'm looking forward to reading lots more of his stuff.
Lovely shiny covers.
I love the
shiny covers is what attracted to me.
The tilty, shiny magpie cover there, yeah.
It is really the reason why I got the first book.
Ooh, that one's got a hologram on. that's a bad reason to pick up a book. But
it turned out it was a brilliant reason to pick up a book. It's a good book.
Actually, I recommend Alastair Reynolds. I'd probably skip The Prefect for now. Go for Revelation Space, I think. That's probably going to be the
start
plan.
Start at the beginning.
Start at the beginning, yeah. But a fantastic, accomplished, interesting cipher. Not quite as utopian and far-fetched as Banks's sort of world views. It's a bit more down-to-earth, a bit more gritty. But still fascinating, speculative, what could humans become?
Something that I have always thought about his works is I would love to see an RPG in that universe.
The world building is very good, yeah.
That, it would be an ideal place for a game to be set. Screw Mass Effect, put it in there or something.
But yeah, really good sort of detail building up the sort of society they're all in. I recommend it,
yeah.
Okay. Excellent, over to you.
I'm talking about something.
You got a thing?
Yes, and talking about game tie-ins.
Oh, yeah.
This is something which is owned by a game developer.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Rebellion.
Okay.
This is 2000 AD, which is a comic. Unashamedly a comic.
You're not going to call it a graphic novel or something?
No, it's unashamedly a comic.
Okay. This is the bit where I predictably enough say I'd never really got into comics and don't understand them.
Well, was it a couple of years ago?
I do try to read one now and then. I'll borrow some from you and I try and go through them. And I borrowed The Dark Knight Returns, is it? I had a go and it was... I'm not going to bother even going into reviewing it here, but just the activity of reading comics, I just don't know if I'm doing it right or if I'm not getting the same things out of it. Because I'm a huge fan of 1,000-page doorsteppers. That prefect there, that's probably another 500 pages, you know?
Yeah.
And just words, and I don't know.
Did I lend you the animated version as well?
No.
Dark Knight? I should have lend you the animated version.
I think you lent me some 2000 AD as well. I haven't got around to those.
You should read them, they're good.
I will.
Now, right, 2000 AD, for those that don't know, is a comic which has been around since the late 70s.
Mm-hmm. Back when the year 2000 was far in the future.
Yes, it's on. It's not even set in the year 2000.
Oh, okay.
Well, some are, because we'll get to that in a second. It's actually on issue 1882 at the moment.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's been going for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, a couple of years ago, they came out and started doing digital subscriptions.
Okay.
And I jumped on that because I hadn't read it for years. Yeah. It was always a tricky one to read because not enough places around here actually stocked it.
Mm.
So,
like everything else, it's the digital age is coming. Yeah. You adapt or you die. So,
but what happened was, after a while on the digital age, digital version, I decided, hang on, I'm going to get the physical one because I think I prefer reading comics in my hands.
Right.
And so I started getting the physical issues.
Yep.
And I'm very, very happy with this.
Excellent.
Now, what 2000 AD is, what do you think 2000 AD
is? It's Judge Dredd.
Judge Dredd's in it.
That's
but
it.
It's not about
it's
Judge
Dredd. It's just the Judge Dredd comic.
What it is it's a sci-fi and fantasy anthology comic.
Okay.
Each...
I had no idea. I just thought it was Judge Dredd.
No, each week there are five strips in it, which are five different stories.
Okay.
I mean, at the moment, there's always Judge Dredd.
Yep.
The first one's always Judge Dredd. Second one's Indigo Prime this week, which is a multiverse story.
Okay.
Then there's Slain, which is a story set in ancient Albion with lots and lots and lots of scantily clad ladies.
Uh-huh.
Then there's Tharg's Thrillers, Tharg being the alien who edits the thing, which is basically Tharg's Thrillers are a one-off, one-issue story, just a short story type thing.
Okay.
And lastly, there's Outlier, which is a sci-fi story. So each week there's five stories. They rotate in and out, so each story will last a couple of weeks or 10 weeks or a long time. And they will
proper serial stuff.
Yeah, they will disappear off and come back in again later.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, different stories will just drop off and come back when the writers come back to it.
Right.
And it's possibly one of the most interesting ways to get a weekly dose of sci-fi at the moment, because it is always changing.
Okay. So we're talking sort of quite high concept speculative sci-fi, or is it generally people running around with laser guns type stuff?
Could be all of the above.
A bit of both. Okay,
But there's always, one of the things about 2000 AD is it's very political.
Right.
It's always been very political, so there's always an undercurrent.
There's always a lot of that with Judge Dredd.
Basically a commentary on conservative governments and fascism and various other things. So, because, you just need to take Dredd and what he represents, which is a state where the laws are incredibly strict. There is no due process.
What happens when there's too much law?
And, it's basically about what happens when the democracy failed. Because... In Judge Dredd, democracy was a failed experiment.
Okay.
Went wrong and stuff had to happen. Because it's different each week and uses different artists, there is a vast array of different graphical styles.
I suppose that's one way. Yeah, the one thing I sort of seem to miss with this stuff is looking at them as essentially a collection of interesting artwork, which I suppose I get too wrapped up in trying to follow a story rather than taking time to appreciate the, you know, the design and the skill of the artist there.
Yeah, if we take this latest issue, which is out on Wednesday, you get them early if you subscribe.
Ooh.
There's the classic, what you would consider a classic graphic novel style for some of it. The Judge Dredd at the moment is a quite interesting, a bit more DC-ish type look at the moment, but that will change. Mm-hmm. Then there's some almost photorealistic style to it.
Okay, yeah, that's unusual.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And then there's Slane, which is very, very painterly, paint splats everywhere.
Yeah, very quite impressionistic almost.
And the fact that it changes all the time is very, very good. I mean, even with
keeps it interesting. Yeah.
Even with a multi-week story, they'll change the artists along the way, mm-hmm. so it may completely change art style halfway through.
Yeah, okay.
Which actually works really well.
It doesn't get too familiar or repetitive.
No, and it's just a really, really interesting set of stories that they cover.
Okay,
I think possibly the one shots they do, the one-off sci-fi stories are the most interesting, because they tend to just come up with, as you mentioned, with a short story, one idea, do it, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And really do it well, which is something that, you know...
That seems different to what I imagine comics to be, which is, I don't know, say, to Batman or something, where it just goes on and on and on for hundreds of weeks about the same character, possibly different cases or different villains, but
well, it's
essentially not changing that much.
It's got that with Dredd, but... Mm. They still change the world in Dredd.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's only a couple of comics.
I sort of sometimes tangentially hear people who follow this kind of thing getting all excited about crises of infinite Earths and, you know,
yeah.
big attempts to shake everything off and kill off some key characters and, you know, totally mix things up, because presumably long-running familiarity and similarity are a problem or a trap to avoid.
You need something big to get people to come back in.
Is it about shocking sensationalism to get bums on seats?
Yeah. To remind people why they liked it in the first place.
Yeah.
And Dredd does it as well. But the thing about Dredd is the continuity is solid.
Yeah.
After a rocky patch at the start, everything that happens, happens.
So you don't get these sort of sudden reboots that try and throw everything away.
No.
And,
And also, Dredd ages in real time.
Okay.
So, yeah, he, as old as he was in 79, he's older now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's year per year.
Which puts an interesting problem ahead of them at some point.
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
He's going to die at some point.
It covers the fact that he's ageing and slowing down.
How old is he supposed to be now?
Oh.
In his sort of 50s or 60s or something?
He's older than that, I think. But
okay.
I think he's meant to be around Clint Eastwood's type.
Okay. Fair enough.
But, you know, it's the future and there's technology.
Yeah,
and stuff,
you can always plot device your way out of that kind of problem if you get stuck.
But it's just a remarkably consistent book each week, which has entertaining stories in. If you like sci-fi.
Cool.
If you don't like sci-fi, then you're probably out of luck.
Hmm.
If you want spandex superheroes, you're out of luck.
Oh, I'm not even going to start on Golden Ages and Silver Ages and stuff, because I'm well out of my depth already.
But yeah, it's really... I know it's got a bit of a reputation as a grown-ups comic,
because of it's like, not for kids. Just very violent.
It's very, very, very violent. There's lots of sex occasionally, and it's not for kids.
Right, fair enough.
But and it's very political.
Is that what people try to distinguish when they use the term graphic novel instead of comic?
I think what they're after there is respect.
Fair enough. You get to a certain point, you just don't care anymore. That's fine.
But it's been going since February 1977.
Blimey. Mind you, there are others that have been going much longer, haven't they?
So, oh, there are, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but
in one form or another.
You just need to look at, say, Superman and Batman. Batman's, what, the 70th anniversary, is it? 75th or something?
God, yeah, 30s.
Yeah.
Blimey.
Although, it should be said that the continuity is not...
That's fair enough.
The early issues of that were really, really weird. They were really weird.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not talking 60s TV show weird then, just really weird.
No, weirder than the 60s TV show. Yeah. There was a bit with a bike, yeah, it was weird.
Mm. I'll take your word for it.
Although, actually, I will mention that there is at the moment Batman 1966, or Batman 66, which is a comic version of the 60s TV show.
That's my favourite Batman, yeah. I think.
So it's proper comics.
I haven't seen Ben Affleck at work yet, but Adam West still my favourite.
He looks too brooding. Batman shouldn't be brooding. Batman should be Adam West. A bit podgy.
Wearing
something completely inappropriate.
And very safety conscious,
and
indeed.
And very, very safety conscious.
Yes. it's a 2000 AD, then.
So I just remembered that Batman's coming out on DVD this year.
What, the D60s yeah. series? Ah, oh, brilliant.
I'm so buying that.
Yes. So boring, that.
So, 2000 AD.
Where did we get this then? Presumably you can find it in newsagents and stuff, but...
If there was such a thing as a newsagent, your local comic book store will have it, and a good bookshop will have it.
But for the e-stuff, you can get tablets, subscriptions,
yeah, on. You could go to...
Download PDFs or whatever.
You could go to 2000adonline.com.
Okay.
And there's the RM3 subscriptions.
Okay.
Or you could go along on your iPad and get it through iBooks.
Okay. So plenty of ways to get hold of the stuff.
And also,
how much does it cost an episode then? An edition?
Issue, whatever. Each issue is £2.45 every Wednesday.
That's quite reasonable, really.
Yeah. I mean,
there are bags of crisps that cost that nowadays.
Yeah, I know. Well, I forget how many pages it is, but it's a comic sized.
Yeah. Like 30, 40 pages there, was it? Decent.
It's definitely worth it. And if you can get over the fact that you don't like comics, I'd recommend you read some.
I'll have a go. I probably need to read Watchmen or something at some point.
No, don't start with Watchmen.
That's the one everyone goes on about all the time. I like the film. I'm probably some sort of pariah.
I've never seen a film before, but I think I will start with Citizen Kane, because I've heard it's the best.
Well, I don't want to muck around with rubbish. Go straight to the genre-defining archetype, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to talk about another book. Let's round off. I've got Stephen Baxter's Titan here, which is...
I'm noticing a pattern here.
Is it sci-fi?
Is it big space opera?
A big space opera? No. Red Sea under... Red Skies good point, under Red Seas and things. That was more of a swords and sorcery, well, fantasy type of... sort of thing. Now, this one is a near future novel, which charts mankind's first attempt to colonise Titan, the moon
of
Saturn.
That's a stupid thing to do.
It is a pretty stupid thing to do, and as the book goes on. Basically, the book opens with an atrocious shuttle disaster. I don't know when this was written, whether it was pre-Columbia or post-Columbia or whatever. 1997. So, this was written, so it was after, wasn't it? The big.
It was after one in 1986. Anyway,
you get the first couple of chapters of character establishment and so on. I can't remember the woman's name. It's Paula Benserif, she's called, and she's an engineer working on the International Space Station, I think. And the shuttle flight back down goes wrong, and they all have to jump out. I don't think it goes wrong in such a fashion that they're able to parachute out of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is lucky, because then she can still take part in the rest of the book. But basically, this causes a massive stink and a big political upheaval that cans and mothballs the shuttle program, and basically puts an end to Western space exploration for the foreseeable future. And basically, the political climate of the book has a sort of Western civilization, mostly with America, entering a phase of kind of sort of self navel-gazing nihilism in the face of Chinese improved. And advances in their own space race. You know, almost at the same time this shuttle's blowing up, the Chinese have launched their first manned space mission into orbit and so on. And so basically it's a sort of maverick gang of scientists and engineers trying to convince the American government to go for Titan as a colonization project against the background of fading Western power in the world.
This is actually quite prescient, because it's basically what's happening in
partly. I mean, it depicts an America in a much, much worse state than today. But that and China seem to be unfeasibly successful at whatever they're doing. Basically, it's a big old political tract, I think. Because I remember reading, tangentially, Stephen Baxter also has another book called Voyage, which is about a first manned mission to Mars. And I haven't read that one, but Radio 4 did a fantastic audio drama of it a couple of years ago, and I taped that, of course, listened to it again. And basically, I think Stephen Baxter has got a real problem with the space shuttle. I don't know if he's an astronaut or an ex-astronaut or trained to be an astronaut. He knows a lot about the technical stuff that goes on. I mean, the all throughout all the various space sections and rockety sections in this book, we get a whole huge amount of detail, and I get the impression Baxter either does his research or just knows very well what the actual physical nuts and bolts of real-life rocketry
is. Or can use Wikipedia.
Or can use Wikipedia, I don't know. But you get a lot of... a lot of technical detail with all the various space missions.
He's got degrees in mathematics and engineering.
Yeah. I guess he knows his stuff. I mean, I don't know enough. He's convincing enough to bluff me anyway, let's put it that way. So, so basically the book charts the sort of putting together of a last gasp attempt by the American-led West to do any kind of space colonization at all. And they sort of just bypass Mars entirely and decide to go straight for Titan, because apparently it's made up of the right kind of hydrocarbons and all the rest of it.
Well, it's hard sci-fi, so it might be.
Yeah, well, the first half of the book is all the sort of political maneuverings and wranglings of getting the mission together and the test flights and all the, you know, we've only got, like... And they have to sort of start, you know how a lot of the Saturn V rockets ended up as big sort of big landmarks in driveways and parks and stuff leading up to NASA and so on. Yeah. They're all just left out in the road. They haven't end up having to recommission some of those so they can get the rockets back together again. Things have been sitting out by the side of the road for 30 years in a desert. And so the second half of the book's the mission itself, and I honestly don't think I've ever come across a more unlikable ensemble cast in any kind of narrative journey ever.
Wow.
I know, it's just awful. The people don't get on. There's all sorts of really stupid accidents and mistakes they make on the journey. I don't mind spoilering this book, to be honest, because I think only three of them make it to Titan out of a crew of five or so, and five isn't a stable gene pool anyway.
What was that BBC TV show? Survivors?
Outcasts?
Outcasts, was it?
That made them look like blinking...
Wow.
International Rescue. It was fantastic, this thing. So they get there and it's really hard work, and we get lots of descriptions of what Titan's like. I mean, it has a sort of speculative pseudo-factional piece, you know, fact-type exploration of the solar system. It's quite interesting. We get a lot of descriptions of how the rocketry all works, and we get a lot of interesting descriptions of what life on Titan would be like, what it's made of, what it looked like, the natural features and so on. And that's all quite interesting, but the people he's created for this journey are just really unsympathetic and unlikable for most part, and you're sort of really quite ambivalent to them dying off one by one during this doomed mission towards the end there. Then there's a bit of sort of distant sort of sci-fi epilogue that sort of follows on from the end of this, where, you know, we sort of look at the greater picture and stuff. But on the whole, I just found the people so unlikable that I just really didn't care if humankind survived or made it to the stars or lived or died on Titan at all either. So, yeah, I don't know if I'd recommend it. I think it's interesting if you want to have someone, you know, explain some of the nuts and bolts of rockets and distant solar planetary bodies and stuff to you in pseudo-scientific terms. But as a kind of story, as a narrative, as an adventure even, which I think, you know, space colonization would, I think you'd be much better off going with Red Mars and Kim Stanley Robinson's massive opus there. It's much better than... Red Mars is much better than this. And you're looking at me like that.
I don't like Red Mars.
No, you're not a fan. I love those three. I think they're fantastic. The Red Mars series carries a real kind of optimistic note to... Yes, the individuals are complex and sometimes unlikable people in Red Mars, but the whole sort of adventure that is humankind making progress into the future is really palpable in Red Mars and Blue Mars and Green Mars and whatever. You know, you get the sense that here is a species doing well, even though some of them aren't likable and don't do well themselves. Whereas this book here, it seems like, you know, our humanity's progress into the future is resting on the back of five really unlikable people and a species who just deserve to be made extinct.
A bit like real life.
It's
then.
Really bleak. And it shouldn't be bleak, because it's about the wonders of science fiction, the wonders of, you know, near future science fiction, the wonders of us, people like you and me, getting out there and expanding our horizons and making our race better. And it just never really comes across at all. So I don't think I'd recommend this, to be honest. I don't know if Stephen... Have you any Stephen Baxter stuff?
Yeah, I've read some.
So what did you think? I can't work out if this is just particularly bitter. He seems really bitter about the direction real-world space travel has
gone.
Oh,
he is, yeah.
Really, really quite axe-grindy about it all.
Well,
and that comes across quite painfully and obviously and repeatedly in his books.
I like hard sci-fi, but I think that from what I've read of his, he does tend to get a bit distracted by the details.
He's an engineer, not a storyteller, I think.
Well,
I don't know.
I'm trying to think. Some of the, not too... I want to say nice things, but think back about it. Yeah,
he knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff. Yeah,
the tech and the engineering described in there are interesting in themselves, but I'm just not sure if it's enough to carry the whole thing.
Yeah,
which is a shame.
I'm desperately looking for his list of books to see the ones I read to think.
So I really enjoyed Voyage, but what I think I enjoyed Voyage was the audio play adaptation, the cast and the direction of it, the people that did that, rather than the novel itself. I think if I went back and actually read the book, I think I'd probably have.
I think it would be a good experiment. Maybe you should after that read Titan and Moonseed.
Oh, this is Titan.
Oh, yeah.
Voyage is the one I probably ought to read the book on.
That's a trilogy.
Okay, yeah. Oh, this is the first of a trilogy, is it?
Well, Voyage is first, then Titan, Moonseed.
NASA trilogy. Voyage, Titan, and Moonseed.
They're three connected books with the general.
This is quite similar to Voyage. It's about Titan. It's a different mission, but the similar kind of setup and similar thing. Yeah, Moonseed. Okay.
Yeah.
So has he done more sort of out-and-out science fiction about aliens and distant worlds and stuff? Because I'm building up quite a bad picture of the man, I think.
Yeah, you probably want to start with some of his other stuff, like his early stuff.
I guess he's more famous for other things.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an awful lot. And also,
yeah, that's quite a bibliography. Look at that.
See, the last thing I read was The Long Earth.
Okay.
Which was him and Pratchett.
Him and Terry Pratchett. That might be interesting, yeah.
Yes, it's very, very interesting. Okay. Yeah, there's lots of stuff.
So I wonder if I'm picking up an unfair angle. I just wouldn't recommend this.
You are coming at
a straight-in introduction to the man.
You are coming in at a very specific point. And it's probably worth looking at one of his others, like Doctor Who novel, maybe.
Oh, God. Fair enough. It's another 600 pages. I'm spotting a pattern here. I mean, I think 300 pages of that is basically a massive, palm-thumping exercise in telling NASA off and having a go at the short-sightedness of Western space exploration planning. And then the other half is just a sort of catalogue of things that can go wrong if you're trying to land and settle on Titan. It's just sort of came away from it all thinking, glad that's over, which is a shame.
I think maybe you should start with one of his earlier books, like Raft or something.
Okay. So, yeah, I don't think I've given up on the man entirely, but I'm not sure I'd recommend this one anyway. But if you do want to find it, that's £7, and you can find it the same place you find all the other books.
So what you're basically saying is all the books are the same price, they come from the same store.
And about the same length as well. I think that's probably just me rather than books in general. I think they're probably shorter books and more expensive ones.
I do have books that are different lengths than the ones you have. I think all your books
No,
are
all
same
books
length.
Are 600 pages. We're not worth writing about otherwise.
Yes.
That's a pamphlet otherwise. I'd have to go back and count the pages in Lord of the Rings.
That's a guaranteed sequel. You can't end.
Trilogies are the future.
No, trilogies are so out. It's continuing series now.
I was in London yesterday, out and about, meeting some of the listeners and some of the Mumble friends. That was fantastic day out, and we found ourselves in Forbidden Planet, and downstairs they've got a book section. And you know how in most books there's like three shelves of science fiction and fantasy? In Forbidden Planet there's three shelves of other stuff.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
It's fantastic.
And it was just loads of people in there who were all visibly relieved to be letting their guard down amongst people who understand. It was nice. It was really good.
It's a safe place.
Yeah, but they had a box set of all the George R. R. Martin Game of Thrones stuff for £65, and it was about 2 feet long. I thought I'm gonna have trouble getting that home on the train. But I do think I want to start reading the Game of Thrones stuff, having seen all the TV, because I think I'm probably missing a lot.
I find it incredibly hard to get into those books. I've bounced off the first one repeatedly.
Oh, I have no trouble bouncing off doorstep
of
paperbacks
because of the names. Names get me. The names are stupid.
Fair enough. So, have you got anything else to talk about?
I think we've gone on far longer.
Okay, then. What did you learn this week?
I learned that Robin Aitken-Downs has actually been in more games than Nolan North has.
He's everywhere and you don't notice because he's an actor.
Yes.
And can change his voice. And like Nolan North, who is just a bloke who can talk a lot. Yes.
Yeah, far too much, it turns out.
Nolan North has one voice, and it's even selectable by name in Saints Row 4.
Yeah.
Robert Aitken-Downs is everywhere and has a variety of accents. Sometimes he sounds a bit like Sean Connery, and sometimes he has a terrible Irish accent.
Oh, Saboteur is fantastic.
Fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, I wrote some code that was going through IMDb, pulling out the voice list for all games.
Oh, I'd love to see your final results of all that, because I'm very interested in voice acting. Much more interested in voice actors than actual Hollywood screen actors and stuff, to be honest.
Well, the crossover. The problem I've got with it is you go through the games, the highest number is 299 for one guy.
Wow.
But it's when you get onto the real actors who've done stuff.
Mm.
Like you tag Mark Hamill because he's in everything, and then boom, it starts putting on the Star Wars. And the worst one is some of the Wing Commanders and Saints Row
mm-hmm.
have actresses in it who have worked in other areas.
Adult entertainment industries, yes. Yes.
And once you hit one of them with your spider, my God.
What can, yeah, you know, cannot be unseen.
Normal actor, well, you don't see anything because it's just going in the background, but normal actor, a title a year?
Yeah.
Yeah, 200 titles per year. It takes
porn
forever.
Actors and actresses, quite busy people.
They're very busy people.
Wow.
It turns out.
Well, this week I learned that there is such a thing as M&M World, and it has four floors. We were all pressed up against the window wondering what the hell could necessitate a building so big.
Did you go in?
No, because we were terrified by it all. It was a strange day
they
out.
They sell M&Ms.
It was a lovely day out, though, but we didn't go into M&M World, no, because they only do M&Ms.
And that was a wasted opportunity.
I know. Strange days, I tell you, strange times. Do your spiel.
You can go along to howtometatime.com and find all our previous episodes, including there was one ages ago about Red Mars.
Oh, yes, I did actually do a book thing about Red Mars a while back.
Yeah, which is available on the list.
Yes.
Go to the menu, there's a list there.
Go and see what I thought about that.
You can also go along to iTunes and leave us a review, because that'll be spiffing.
Leave us some comments, let us know if you'd like to hear more about books and TV things, because this is something we may do more of in the future.
I think we are, whenever we can't think of a topic, really.
Also, let us know your topic show ideas, because we had trouble this week.
You can also catch me on Moving On Mondays.
Yep.
This week, it's Broken Arrow.
Oh, wow.
I love that film.
Christian Slater and John Travolta.
Yeah.
About the stealth bomber missing bombs thing.
Yeah. Not to be confused with Face Off, which is a very, very similar cast.
I love Face Off. Face Off's fantastic.
Yes, and also on Thursdays you can catch me on The Brainstorm.
Okie dokie.
Join us next week when we will be...
It's a board game one next week, is it?
No, it's normal games next
normal
week.
What we've been playing?
Yeah.
Okay, dokie.
I better play some games which aren't Minecraft.
Yeah, let's play something that isn't Minecraft, otherwise that's going to be a long show.
I started playing Wolfenstein.
Okay.
Then you turned up and I had to stop playing
Wolfenstein. Oh, sorry. Oh, it's my fault, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you're ruining the show by making the show.
Sorry. With that, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Probably.